75 years ago, the United Nations was formed. And so we thought it would be a good idea to celebrate that anniversary by getting an expert to talk to us. And so today, it's my pleasure to introduce Associate Professor Bethan Greener from Massey University, who is that expert on the United Nations, who's going to talk to us a bit about the United Nations at 75, really the origins, the watersheds, and the future of United Nations. So without further ado, would you please welcome Bethan, and I'll just tweak that slightly so you don't get it. Over to you, Bethan.
Thank you. Just trying to think if it's morning or afternoon. It's been a bit like that at the moment. It's just completely crazy. As kind of mentioned, my name is Beth Greener, and I am at the program that's called Politics and International Relations up at Massey University. In terms of my own engagement with the UN, I've done a fair amount of research in UN peacekeeping generally, and I have engaged particularly with, interestingly, the policing side of the house, so the use of UN police on missions, and also the UN Office of Drugs and Crime. But I've always been fascinated by the UN as an actor and how it functions or doesn't function, as the case might be. And obviously some of the things I'll mention today you may already know or have operational experience with yourselves. So we can have a chance at the end, I think, to have a bit of a discussion about things that particularly interest you. The other thing to note, I just realised on Monday I'm actually going to go and meet 2ER, so have a talk to some of the engineers. We're also currently doing a research project engaging with engineers in particular in logistics at the moment, so it's great to have a chance to talk to you as well. So thinking about the genesis of the UN, one of the things that really strikes me is that in 1945 everyone was still quite so willing, after the failure of the League of Nations, to think that an international organisation was still very much needed. And there was consensus on that amongst the great powers, which again, at a time where you have very different ideologies and different national objectives, the fact that you could have, in particular, the Big Five that were on the Security Council agree that such an organisation was necessary, I think is quite a feat in and of itself. And I'm also always interested to point my students to actually have a look at the UN Charter, because it's quite a... it's a very broad-ranging document, and you can see when you look at the Charter some of the things that have come to be that were envisaged by the signatories to the Charter and some of the things which have fallen by the wayside. So one of the things that my students don't realise is that Article 44 allows for a military committee run by the UN to potentially facilitate the UN basically having a command and control system over national contingents rather than it being kind of more the other way around in terms of national control contributing to a UN mission. So there was this idea of a need for international peace and security. This was to be vested in the Security Council. So today I'm predominantly going to speak to, again, kind of more the political and security side of things. Obviously there's an awful lot of work that was ongoing in terms of the economic and social emphases that the UN has had over the years. And what's interesting is when we come to the end, you'll see that a lot of these big, heavy political and security issues are not currently on the table for the UN in terms of what it thinks it can achieve. And that's largely because, again, a stalemating is starting to occur within the organisation between competing interests. So the question, too, when the UN came into being was, what kind of structures do we want? And there was some learning from the failure of the League of Nations, which had been based on a unanimous decision-making model. So hence the idea of those five great powers having the power of veto. In essence, they were vested with the responsibility for international peace and security. So we had the UN Security Council with these five great powers, obviously, the US, France, Britain, China, at the time the nationalist government, and the USSR. And again, we can look at that because that still exists today. And given the fact that I'm actually British, I can have a small giggle about the UK and France being seen to necessarily be these significant global powers in the face of rising other powers such as India or Brazil or Indonesia or wherever we want to go. But veto power was obviously very controversial, but it was something which the Big Five insisted upon, otherwise they weren't going to sign up. New Zealand and Australia made very concerted efforts to try and get rid of the veto power. So veto power clearly being that those five countries can essentially axe or prevent a UN Security Council resolution from being enacted or coming into being. And it really is the decision, although we have the General Assembly, which is every single country is allowed to be represented, so we currently have 193 member states. When the UN was created, it was more like 50. And we also have a number of territories with observer status, and there's a lot of contestation around who gets to be a member of the General Assembly. So obviously talking under Murray McCulley's tenure as Foreign Minister, New Zealand did try and support, for example, the Palestinian cause in terms of being recognised as a sovereign state. So the UN is interesting from that point of view. Every state can be represented, but yet there is a disparity of power in terms of who gets to determine the agenda and what gets to have the rubber stamp of the UN. It is still considered to be the main international law-making body of the international community, but it goes through peaks and troughs in terms of exactly what it can do or can't do, because the UN is made up of member states. So the UN as an institution often gets blamed, but it can only work with the material it gets. And as we know, that's the political will or lack of will of members, but also things like in peacekeeping operations, the capabilities of the personnel they send, the ethics of the people they send, the way they hold people accountable for their actions offshore, those sorts of things as well. And that varies hugely across different states. And the other thing which we had, so within the UN system we have the UN Security Council, the General Assembly, the Economic and Social Council, which actually spends more than three-quarters of the UN's budget, but we tend to hear more about the Security Council side of things, and a number of other structures. So some of the auxiliary bodies that were created were things like the various courts of justice, the International Court of Justice, or things like the signing of the UN Declaration of Human Rights and the various human rights bodies that came into being as well. So when we look at maps of the UN, it's huge, it's unwieldy, and that's one of the critiques of it, is that it's very inefficient. There's also obviously the Secretariat, which is where the Secretary General resides. That has recently been streamlined after a whole lot of reports about issues of transparency and accountability. But the thing that's really obvious is that thus far, to be a Secretary General, you had to be both a guy, we haven't had a female one yet, and also have a really cool name, because we've had some amazing names over the years. We've had Trygev Lai, Dag Hammarskjöld, Boutros Ghali, Kofi Annan, and the current Antonio Guterres as well. So no point trying to be Secretary General if you are Joe Blocks, I'm afraid. Okay. So one of the things I thought would be worthwhile talking today, and some of you may be experts in this yourself and know quite a lot about the history of the UN, but I thought it was worth, because we're in a bit of a moment, I think, with the UN being stymied, we can talk about that at the end. We have had other times throughout the UN's tenure or existence where it has been similarly incapable of acting in the face of differing state interests. And one of the questions about the UN is that, one of the phrases that's often said is, if it didn't exist, we'd have to invent it, because it's the one international organisation in the world where states can come, bring their priorities, their conflicts, and have a forum within which to speak. So simply having that open diplomacy, multilateral diplomacy, the ability to negotiate, those sorts of things, it seems to be really, really valuable. So the diversity of the UN is often held up as its greatest strength, but also its greatest weakness at the same time. So the period, of course, which we can easily recognise that the UN was quite stymied in terms of its ability to agree on how to act in international affairs, was during the Cold War. So it comes into being in October, 24th of October 1945, and pretty much we've got Churchill talking about the Iron Curtain descending. Very quickly we have the Soviets not wanting to come out of Iran. We have a whole kind of hotting up of what becomes the Cold War. That wasn't intentional, that pun. So the UN meets quite a few times in its first... The UN Security Council convenes a number of times in the first year, but very quickly that drops away as it becomes apparent that anything that the USSR wants to have happen is vetoed by the Americans and vice versa. As that Cold War ideology gains traction and kind of moves along. However, the UN still manages to adapt, and in particular in the realm of peacekeeping. So the Cold War has the superpower competition occurring, and it's interesting today when we hear talk about how the current strategic environment is planning out and what that might look like. When some people are kind of talking about a second Cold War at the moment between the US and China, and then other people critique that to say, well, no, it was a very different context, or no, you're creating it by insisting that this strategic competition is there, or no, because it's not a helpful kind of concept for framing or articulating areas where there might be competition, because there may also be areas where there's cooperation. So I guess the issue that I'm talking about there is, even in a period of highly intense competition between two significant superpowers in a bipolar context, the UN found ways to kind of navigate around that. And one of the biggest concerns was that small localized conflicts would bring in superpower competition. So that's something we've kind of already had the experience of World War I, where this assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand in Serbia resulted, in Sarajevo, resulted in a kind of chain reaction effect as different countries came in on the sides of various allies. So the UN is really concerned that, say, a small conflict over, say, ideology issues or that sort of thing occurring inside a state or potentially between two smaller states not result in large superpowers weighing in with their, particularly with their nuclear arsenals. So they say we need to isolate those conflicts from superpower interest, and peacekeeping in part is born at that point in time. So Dag Hammarskjöld is credited with coining the idea as the Secretary General, and it is said that peacekeeping isn't written anywhere in the UN Charter. So you've got Chapter 6, which is all of the efforts the UN can do, which are below the threshold of the use of force. So those are things like your economic sanctions and your political pressures. And then you have Chapter 7, which is when the UN can authorise the use of force. But as we know, the only time the UN can authorise the use of force is in self-defence, under Article 51 of the UN Charter, collective self-defence as well. So it kind of doesn't really fit within the remit. So it's often called Chapter 6.5. In terms of it, sort of, it's a bit like Harry Potter's platform, you know, whatever. It's not quite really there. And I can't believe I just relayed peacekeeping to Harry Potter. But anyway, but basically it demonstrates that the organisation is attempting to enable some sort of capacity of an international organisation to mediate or to help foster international peace and security, or to help maintain that, which is essentially the underpinning idea of what the UN is for. It first comes out, the first peacekeeping effort is UNSO in 1948, where they're monitoring the truce between Israel and other Arab states. And the first armed peacekeeping mission is during 1956 Suez Crisis with the UN Emergency Force. And we begin to see the practice, generate from there. And as we know, peacekeeping, in its traditional sense, is the insertion of a neutral, impartial force with the consent of the parties involved. So the idea is that they're supposed to be a peace to keep. They are supervising a truce. They are monitoring a peace agreement that's already in effect. But as we know, that soon came to be challenged, and we have very complex peacekeeping, indeed peace enforcement mandates today. The only other thing which demonstrated the UN attempting to initiate or to embody one of its ideals. So the ideal of the UN is very much three musketeers, all for one and one for all. So the idea of the UN is supposed to be collective security. Every single member state guarantees the sovereignty of every other member state through its engagement with the UN system. And in 1950, in June that year, we see North Korean forces coming over the 38th parallel after the division of Korea after World War II. And by sheer dint of luck, the Soviet Union at the time is boycotting Security Council meetings. And they're boycotting Security Council meetings because they want to see the nationalist government no longer sit in the seat that is dedicated for China. They want to see the Communist Party representing that seat instead. And by sheer luck, They are not in the chamber when on June the 27th the UN votes for military action in Korea. Really strangely, it sometimes gets called police action, and that's in part because, again, it was an attempt to conceive of this as a more controlled, I guess, use of force in order to kind of have this within a kind of political setting rather than the idea that it was in a war-fighting setting. But it obviously was very much a war in terms of the methods used and the outcomes as well. So UN Command was created in July 1950, and in October that year, first UN forces land on the Korean Peninsula. So from then we have, again, the UN increasingly gets stymied. The Cuban Missile Crisis occurs in the 60s, although it does provide, again, a forum for conversation about those issues. But essentially, the role of the UN in peace and security is largely couched in that traditional peacekeeping space. So it's supposed to be in instances such as Cyprus, where we have, you know, divided communities and the patrolling of a ceasefire, or on the Golan Heights, or the demilitarized zone that then is created in Korea between north and south. So this is effectively where the UN is able to function. It's basically, its peacekeepers are usually very lightly armed, only mandated to use force and self-defense, and quite significant rules in and around that. And that's basically the kind of narrow confines within which it can function. And I think we're seeing a return to some of those confinements happening in particular spaces. Then we have the end of the Cold War. Bit of a shock. I remember people were writing their PhD theses on why the, you know, superpower competition would last forever in the 1980s, and then they had to turn around and suddenly revise that. So, of course, we have we were just talking before about glasnost and perestroika, with Gorbachev coming into power. A whole array of reasons why people believe the Soviet Union effectively lost kind of internal control, particularly over its Baltic republics, but they're largely put down to things like inefficiencies of economy, the war in Afghanistan, and social movements wanting change within the Soviet Union as well. But as the Soviet Union essentially crumbles and loses its cohesiveness, of course, the international environment changes. The Cold War is over, the Berlin Wall comes down, and the UN looks like it could be resurgent as actually an institution which functions in a more active way. And this is kind of brought into being through the response to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Saddam Hussein basically invades Kuwait over a period of 2 days in August 1990. And then very quickly the UN convenes, quickly for the UN, convenes. I have to couch that in kind of particular terms. And by November 1990, we have all members of the Security Council voting on Resolution 678. And Resolution 678 is essentially Saddam Hussein, you must remove yourself from Kuwait, or you will face a UN effort that is mandated to use all necessary means. We've now come to see all necessary means as meaning the use of force. So he doesn't comply with the ceasefire, and a US, basically US command and control, but UN mandated effort is then launched. Interestingly, so UNSCR 678 initiates military action against Saddam Hussein. So it looks like collective security is working. Kuwait calls for help and the international community responds. So George Bush Sr. Talks a lot about a new world order at this point in time. We're seeing the US emerging as the sole superpower and the UN agenda being influenced quite a lot by what the West is kind of wanting to see happen. So I think one of the things that's quite interesting is there's this lovely, echo. So UN Security Council Resolution 678 initiates the war. Resolution 687 is what ends it. Also, of those who voted, you have 12 voting for the resolutions, one against, but they're not a they're not a permanent member, so they don't have the power of veto, and two abstain, who are Russia and China at the time. Same thing happens also when the resolution is created that ends the war. And really importantly, Resolution 687, which closes the military campaign, I think it all up, it was about 43 days, basically says Saddam Hussein, but pretty much pushes Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. There is debate about whether or not to go on and depose him at that point in time, and we have people like Wolfowitz, who later on continues to campaign under George Bush Jr. for the removal of Saddam Hussein. We basically have a question as to now what to do with this aggressor, and the whole list of requirements is drawn up under a ceasefire arrangement, which Saddam Hussein over the following years doesn't hold to. So in 2003, when there's a re-emergence of hostilities, the US says that basically he did not keep to his end of the bargain, so therefore they are allowed to reopen hostilities, because these efforts in 1991 were contingent upon Saddam Hussein allowing things like weapons inspections to not enter into no-fly zones in the south, and that he had constantly flouted those rules. So we'll return to that in a moment. So the UN is kind of buoyed up at this point in time. It's functioned as a collective security arrangement. Everybody's happy. Saddam Hussein's easily a baddie. It's great. We can deal with that. And out of this, we have, at this point in time, currently have a Secretary General called Boutros Boutros-Ghali. And he did not get on with the Americans, hence why his term came to quite an abrupt end. But he writes a document. So each Secretary General basically determines the direction of the UN, so that they write their own agendas. And his was an agenda for peace. So this was released in 1992. And in it, he wanted a new, reinvigorated, ambitious UN. So one of the key phrases in this document is that the UN has engaged in peacekeeping hitherto with the consent of the parties involved. Great old-fashioned language, but basically saying, up until this point, this is how we've done it. But perhaps we can now be bolder. And basically what happens is his ideas see the UN decide to engage more heavily in Somalia in 1992. However, the 1990s were a difficult, tumultuous time. It's really interesting talking to people who were in the military at that time, and the sheer operational tempo was just you know, constant. So there are a couple of events in particular which point to what the UN was trying to do, where it was failing, where it was succeeding. So Srebrenica was something which the UN was scarred by for quite some time. In June 1992, as we know, there was a massacre in what was supposed to be a UN safe area, a safe zone, as 370 lightly armed Dutch peacekeepers believed they couldn't prevent Serbian soldiers from taking away boys and men and killing 3,000 plus at that point in time. That left a huge psychological scar both on those peacekeepers and on the UN. What is the point of peacekeeping if you can't protect those who who basically under that mandate you're seeking to try and look after? Then we had Somalia. So the UN goes in with a more robust mandate. It basically has, by the end of 1992, the US has offered to lead UNITAF, which is the Unified Task Force in Somalia, and it has in its mandate all necessary means to protect the relief efforts. And essentially this devolves into chasing warlords and hunting them down as they seek to disrupt humanitarian aid efforts, because in Somalia we not only have a collapsed government, warlords, but we have famine and people in very dire predicament. However, the UN draws down in Somalia, and particularly the US gets to be somewhat phobic about engaging in more peace enforcement type activity like that because of the death of a number of Marines, US Marines in Mogadishu, and a very public display of them basically being seen as trophies by the warlords. So this means Rwanda inaction is on the cards. There have been criticisms. New Zealand was on the UN Security Council at the time, And they have recently released a whole lot of documents about how they were calling for the UN to take more action. The UN very shamefully instead tended to draw down its forces. Romeo Dallaire, in particular, pictured up there on the right-hand side, has written a damning account of his attempts to try and get UN support for halting a genocide in 1994, which had resulted in at least 800,000 dead. So it was a moment of shame for the UN. And only very recently, ex-President Bill Clinton has admitted that it was a genocide and that they purposefully did not label it such, because under the Genocide Convention, you're supposed to take action if such things are occurring. So from here, the UN is a little bit shamed and trying to get its house in order. And there comes an opportunity at the end of the 1990s. 1999 was a very, very busy year. You have both UN engagement in Kosovo and then also in Timor-Leste. And as we know, we can talk about the ins and outs of that engagement, but essentially related to the desire for independence for those two territories, the UN engages in all the way through from rubbish collection through to executive policing, where UN police officers would arrest local MPs. So it was a huge thing for the UN. They administered these territories for a number of years. So they provided the policy advice, they helped write the constitutions, and they actually carried out the kind of day-to-day running of these places as, so these were kind of transitional administrative authorities, as local governments came online. So for Kosovo, basically, it was under UN administration from June 1999. It's kind of still in a slightly ambiguous position with regards to the idea of being independent. That was the whole reason for the initiation of the conflict, was a declaration of independence in 1991. It was taken very badly by the former Republic of Yugoslavia. And then also with the UN in Timor, it basically shepherded through a new government from 1999 until declaration of independence in 2002. At that point in time, but continued to be engaged. And there was also a moment in 2006 where the UN actually, interfered rather than the UN, had to return because of civil disruption in the streets. But basically what I'm saying is that the UN has tried to find ways in which it can manoeuvre, has been limited at times by nation states and their own interests. So it's quite curious to again to think about what that means for where we are at the moment. How am I doing for time? Okay, cool. All right, so this is one of the things which I find really interesting. The war against Iraq was a test for the UN in a number of ways, and some say it failed. This is great. In my field, sometimes you can say it failed. Some people will advocate that it failed. Some people say it actually functioned as it should. We have debates all day long. But essentially, after the events of 9/11 in 2001, which saw al-Qaeda undertake a number of attacks on American home territory, the US very quickly, interestingly, under a Republican administration led by George Bush Jr., who had already been suggesting that he was going to be quite a... isolationist isn't quite the right word, but a kind of act in a... national interest manner and in kind of a sole kind of capacity, only kind of utilising diplomacy when was useful. It was interesting to see immediately after the attacks on 9/11, there was a very diplomatic effort by the US at the UN to get allies and to get friends. And the UN responded by the 28th of September, essentially UNSCR 1373, so that's UN Security Council Resolution 1373, is a condemning of the acts of terrorism. And it's a really interesting moment when all states can agree that terrorism is bad, often because terrorism is typically designated or defined as non-state actor action against established state authority. So it was a fairly straightforward thing for member states to agree it's a bad thing. And out of 1375 came a raft of other conventions. So things like states agreeing to track explosives, states agreeing to prevent the financing of terrorist groups, those sorts of things. So we had offshore banks being closed down. We had port and security container initiatives being set up throughout the Pacific and elsewhere to try and better control the movement of goods. Those sorts of things were done under those UN auspices. Then we have the question of how does the UN engage in this with regards to the coming use of force. So the US chose to respond with particularly with military action against al-Qaeda. It perceived that al-Qaeda and in particular Osama bin Laden were being hosted by the Taliban in Afghanistan and sought to remove what they saw as an ongoing threat. So essentially, I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is that there was an invasion of another country, which under UN auspices is not brilliant, but the claim was in part that the Taliban had never really been recognised as a legitimate government. So I think at the time it had Pakistan and Saudi Arabia as the only two governments which formally recognised the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan. So in some ways, then, if you don't recognise it, you're not really invading another state. If you don't recognise the government. And of course the US allied with an awful lot of militias and the Northern Alliance in particular in undertaking its invasion in October. So that's when the air assault began and the ground assault, well, CIA operatives had been sent in advance, but that's when we have the main military effort. And they very quickly take Kabul. But as we know, over the next 20 years, it's a very different story to taking a capital city and then actually being able to bring about peace and security at a country level. So what does the UN do? The UN actually says, well, okay, they were hosting a terrorist organisation under 1373. No country is supposed to provide safe harbour for terrorists. So, okay, maybe it's sort of legitimate. And they offered reconstruction. So we have UNIMA brought in to help UN administration. There's transitional governments put in place. With Hamid Karzai in particular. And the UN, in effect, pretty much is okay with the idea of the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan. The war against Iraq is a very different story. As we know here at the time, Helen Clark was in power and basically said, if it gets a UN mandate, New Zealand will go. If it doesn't get a UN mandate, New Zealand will not go. And that's where things fell down. Because Colin Powell went to the UN to convince the Security Council of a number of things, and in particular that Saddam Hussein had been in constant breach of its ceasefire agreement, so it was being illegal anyway, so that in effect the US had been in a state of hostilities all the way since 1991, so it was just a continuation of that. And then, of course, the other arguments that we had about the fact he'd used chemical weapons against his own population, the Kurds, which had been proved. And that there was a fairly horrific human rights situation, which was true, that he was constantly flouting the no-fly zone in the south, which was true, but also the claim was made that there were weapons of mass destruction, that al-Qaeda operatives had been meeting with Saddam Hussein and that there was a possible risk of terrorists using weapons of mass destruction in US cities, which later on there was not the evidence for, particularly as Hans Blix engaged in quite a comprehensive search for weapons of mass destruction. However, what happens is on the 8th of November 2002, there is a UN resolution, which everyone can agree to, and says, Saddam Hussein, you must comply with Hans Blix and his inspection teams, and that it's a final opportunity to comply or there will be serious consequences. And you have to read into UN words. That is not all necessary means. So they haven't agreed to use force yet. Over November through to March, Hans Blix is conducting his examinations, not finding weapons of mass destruction, but also at times being, you know, things aren't as smooth as they should be in terms of access to some sites. And there's the argument that Saddam is basically stalling and moving weapons around and moving them out of the country and back in. By March, the US decides that enough is enough. They abandon the attempt to get another UN resolution. So they were trying to get a second resolution to use all necessary means against Saddam Hussein. They don't get it. And so the US and the UK and Spain in particular launch a military assault on the 17th of after the 17th of March, when a 48-hour ultimatum expires. France and Russia had said that they would veto any attempts to get a UN stamp for this, but the US thinks maybe it will be okay. Maybe it goes to war against Iraq. There's good reason to. It's got a legal case, although there's a legal case against. And maybe if things go well, then everyone will say that was the right thing to do. And things, unfortunately, don't go well in Iraq. So where we end up is that the international community is now panicking. What are our rules? The UN said don't go. The US went anyway. And then the US turns around and goes, actually, UN, could we have some reconstruction effort? Help, thanks. And the UN goes, oh, okay, I guess we'll do reconstruction. And this is when Helen Clark says, yes, I think engineers got sent. This is when, you know, New Zealand will engage under a UN auspice. But the international community is going, what are our rules? Because the US is doing one thing, and France is saying, no, you can't do that. And so there's a huge debate. And they go back to the fact that in 2001, interestingly, after the Canadians had been accused of atrocities in Somalia and they disbanded the paratroop regiment, the Canadians funded a lot of peacekeeping and funded a report. And they basically went around every country and said, what would you be okay with in terms of intervention? And everyone said, we're not okay with intervention because we're states and we don't like intervention. But they said, we're okay with being told we have certain responsibilities. And maybe if we don't uphold those responsibilities, maybe our sovereignty is, I guess, able to be abrogated. So the Canadians have a committee. They produce this document called the Responsibility to Protect. It's launched at the UN in 2001, and everyone ignores it because nobody wants to know, because why on earth would I, as a state, want to sign up to responsibilities? I just want to do my thing. After the war against Iraq, everyone goes, crap, we really, really need to have some kind of consensus on the use of force. Let's return to that funny document everybody tried to get up and running. So the Responsibility to Protect basically says, first of all, try to prevent conflict. There's a lot of emphasis in prevention. But if there are mass human rights abuses, so you can see this came out of what happened in the 1990s, like in Somalia, in Rwanda, in Srebrenica, if there are mass human rights abuses, we must do something. So the UN now can act in a timely and decisive manner, which is slightly ironic. But, if you know, the UN is not a quick-moving beast, but the idea is that it's theoretically allowed to, if countries manifestly fail to protect their citizen. So we have seen this phrase used, for example, in Darfur. Was one of the first times that it was trotted out. It's been used in Sri Lanka. It's been used in a number of different places. Most notably, it was used in 2011 when the UN mandated an operation to try and protect civilians. So one of the other things that's come alongside what we call R2P, or the Responsibility to Protect, is the idea that the UN is going to specialise in protecting civilians. So in 2011, when Gaddafi was basically shelling civilians in a number of port cities, the UN did mandate, under the Responsibility to Protect, a military operation. What happened, as we know, though, is it wasn't just a defence of the civilians on the ground. It resulted in the death of Gaddafi. And so China and Russia looked at that and went, you just did regime change. We actually mandated, by accident, regime change. And they did not like that. So one of the things in international affairs that fascinates me is precedent. So Russia and China go, oh, okay, so if we sign up now for Responsibility to Protect, are we allowing regime change? Because that's what happened in Libya. So they ran away from this idea of the Responsibility to Protect being able to be something, not that they, particularly Russia, would not have been interested, but in the case of Syria. And that's in part why the international community has not had any traction. But it does get used a lot in other missions that you may or may not hear about. So in particular, MONUC in Congo currently uses the Responsibility to Protect idea to be mandated to neutralise armed groups. If we again read between the lines of UN speak, that means using your helicopter gunships to attack bandits or other people or rebel army that you believe are attacking civilians. So the UN is heavily armed in a number of missions right now in Africa with very expansive mandates. But that kind of goes on quietly, and it's in part because the great powers on that have the power of veto kind of don't care too much about what happens in certain places, but they do care about what happens in other places. So there's no helicopter gunships in Syria, but there are in the Congo. So where are we at now? Okay. Now we have a number of emphases. What we're seeing is the UN, it has tried. So basically with the responsibility to protect, I'll just go back to this, sorry. In 2005, Kofi Annan wanted to leave a legacy of the responsibility to protect, and he did manage to get every single state sign up to the idea that states were supposed to protect the civilians, their citizens. And he managed to do that only on a very limited frame. So basically everyone agreed that genocide was bad, crimes against humanity were bad. So war crimes, everyone agreed, shouldn't happen. And that's in part why the International Criminal Court then came into being. But it's very, very hard to meet that threshold. So for a time there, people were going, what's happening in Zimbabwe? Does that meet a threshold of some sort of, you know, war crime? Not quite. So we can have quite a lot of things happen that aren't seen to meet the threshold. We've had a number of member states say, why doesn't the US get taken to the International Criminal Court for its actions in Afghanistan and Iraq? And again, there's a question of almost every case before the ICC is an African case. So it's seen very much by the developing world as a mechanism for wealthy countries to punish others. Okay, very quickly, where are we at now? The high-level planning on peace operations report in 2015 said the UN has to think more about sustaining peace. Why? We think about Iraq and Afghanistan or Haiti, where things have fallen over time and time again. It's no good putting in a peacekeeping force if you're still doing it 50 years later, a la Cyprus. It's kind of how do we actually bring about change? So there's a lot more emphasis on political solutions. It's a lot more emphasis on local ownership. So I know from my police research that the people who policed in Bosnia took those police manuals to Timor and said, it'll work, it's the same thing. And it doesn't, because the context is different. Also that the UN needs more coherence within itself. Because I went to a police meeting in 2009, and we all went to, it sounds very nice, it was very, very nice, we all went to Turin, which you do, and the UN DPKO at the time, peacekeeping operations was there, police were there, and also the UNDP. And they all exist together in New York, but they hadn't talked to each other, and they were all running policing programs in the same country. So the coherence within the UN system is something that they're really looking at. The other thing which they're really, really looking at is accountability, because there have been a lot of abuse cases coming through the UN, particularly sexual exploitation and abuse of local women and children in particular. So they're the things which the UN is trying to grip up. Sustainable Development Goals sits behind that, 17 goals, including things like peace and security. Action for Peace was launched in 2018, where basically the UN has gone to member states and said, guys, can you please send us competent people who are actually qualified in the things we're asking for, and can you send us enough of them? And that's often a problem. So, like, we know that police are often mandated, the UN might be mandated to send 8,000 police to Sudan, and within a year they've got 1,600. You know, it just takes way too long to get people there. There's also the Women, Peace and Security and the Youth, Peace and Security initiatives, which are basically saying that these are two groups that are often particularly impacted in different ways during conflict and post-conflict situations, and that a lot of the planning hasn't taken into account the needs of particular groups. We can talk about that as we go. Pretty much finishing. So where are we at now? There's a split between the North and the South. What does that mean? That means that the only country that's increasing its peacekeeping presence that's on the Security Council is China, and doing so at a vast rate. Every other developed country is pulling back. New Zealand is currently very, 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 very not committed to UN operations abroad, in terms of numbers anyway. But also the North-South split is, but it's often the rich countries which decide the mandate and then the poor countries which provide the boots on the ground. And that's starting to bite. There's also regionalisation. So in 2004 in Darfur, they trialled, and it's worked, African Union-UN hybrid mission. And that's basically the way the UN is going. So it's also a little bit like what happened with Ramsi.
It was a regional assistance mission with kind of a UN sign-off, but it wasn't a UN mission. That's increasingly what's going to happen. However, they're also having problems because the UN is increasingly finding it is trying to operate in areas where you have significant transnational crime or you have significant numbers of extremist groups that do not want peace. They just don't want to engage in the peace process. So despite you saying we want to kind of police ourselves or military ourselves out of here, that actually you need peace to happen in order for that to be possible. And they're often not interested in the peace agreements that are on the table. NGOs are also increasingly involved in insisting on quite high levels of kind of human security requirements, and that's not necessarily a problem, but they're pointing out the complexity of the issues on the ground and the interplay of everything. And this is currently where we're at. This is what the UN last year, when it kind of hit that 75-year anniversary, it did a huge survey of its member states and populations and said, what should the UN prioritise? And the idea is very much based around a lot of those sustainable development goals, particularly around things like poverty, climate change, peace and conflict, international law and justice, the role of women and girls who are proportionately ill-served, I guess, in a lot of countries in terms of education and health statistics, those sorts of things, improving digital cooperation, boosting partnerships, all those sorts of things. But you can see from this list, it's kind of everyday stuff. It's not reform the UN so that great powers don't have the power of veto. It's not kind of make the UN a world police force. They've kind of moved into the stymied at the moment between different states, partly after Libya, but also the increasingly hardening strategic competition that's occurring between, in particular, Russia, Britain, US and China. There's an awareness in the UN that they're not going to be able to tackle the big kind of picture, the high politics, and instead they're trying to find ways of improving things, contributing to peace and security in ways which are not going to end up in a kind of stalemate because of that combative nature between the great powers. Back in 2005, Kofi Annan also wanted to leave a legacy of changing the veto power, and that fell flat. They just could not get... he wanted to change the veto power and also to change the composition of the council, but just basically large, powerful states say, we're not going to engage in the UN unless we have the power of veto, and that remains today. So that's where we're currently at. Thanks.
Thanks, Beth. I'm sure there are plenty of questions there. Go for it. Peter.
It's a bit odd that the United Nations is based in New York, where the Americans consider themselves the world's policeman anyway.
Yeah. It's a really interesting question. So with the League of Nations, Woodrow Wilson campaigned, was basically the kind of instigator of the League of Nations in 1919. So as the US president came in, campaigned on that, got it, and then the Senate refused to ratify it, so the US never joined the League of Nations. Nicely ironic. And I think after World War II, there was a feeling in the US administration that this was still something that they wanted to do and that they wanted to have a lot more control over how things developed. They came out of World War II as a major power, and therefore, you know, Rockefeller gifted the land, and it was okay, this is where it will be based, but it really didn't get going. And for a long time, until recently, China also used to see the UN as the US's lapdog because in part it was based in the US. It was had been kind of seen to be a vehicle for most of the US interests, but it's also interesting because China is now heavily involved in the UN. They recently had somebody appointed as head of the Food Organization who the US campaigned against, but it, you know, still is starting to happen. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
probably you didn't answer it.
Yeah, well, it's often the way. Yeah. But the question about the world policeman, though, I think is really interesting. Because, yeah, I mean, the US, basically a lot of this stuff has been, the UN can't do it. It doesn't have the command and control capacity in particular. So, you know, 1991 was a US effort. You know, Timor was an Australian-led effort predominantly. And the UN has not built that capacity to really have that level of operational ability. So you are reliant, and that's partly what's gone for that regional stuff, you are reliant on member states to kind of offer up the actual capability. It'll be interesting to see what happens now, because of course Trump was like not going to engage with the UN at all, was not interested. And even Biden, he's much more about the kind of League of Democracies idea and working through the Quad and other alliances. So,
you said that you divided into two or three eras in the UN, one up to the end of the Cold War, and then new opportunity with Pax Americana, more or less, new world order. Would you say that Libya was a watershed point for going to a third era, which is reverting back to regional gridlock?
I think potentially, yeah. And it also, obviously, what's happening about that point in time, too, is we're also seeing Putin taking a hard line in Russia. We're not yet seeing the more hardline approach from the Chinese. That comes very much under Xi. There was a real consternation in the UN that the intent had been... Basically, they'd taken the mickey out of the intent and that they'd been caught napping. And so I think yes, because there had been some trust building to that point. The fact that you got a resolution through like that in the first place... So the UN has also started to talk, it still talks a lot about protection of civilians, and it still tries to say that's how we're doing it. We're not talking about invading states. We're going to just say, look, there are civilians, you're currently in a conflict situation. What the UN can do is try and protect civilians whilst that conflict sorts itself out, try and provide the space, and that's very much what's happened in places like South Sudan, those sorts of things.
And if I can ask a follow-up question on that, the allegations of the use of the word genocide for what's happening in China, is that sort of ringing alarm bells for those members of the V5 movement?
It's really interesting. Tibet tried to kind of claim the term genocide a number of years ago, when it was talking about cultural genocide. And it is kind of one of those words which in the past has been a trigger for action, hence it was avoided. I wonder if in some ways it's a bit like boiling a frog. I think we've become more and more accustomed to the terminology and also the question of what can be done. It kind of doesn't get taken as serious, not taken as seriously as a particular... Because the actual, when you look at the definition of genocide in the Genocide Convention, it's impossible to utilise. It's impossible to operationalise. It's basically once you've killed off an entire group, then you can go, oh yeah, look, genocide happened, which is, it's too late by then. So it's pretty much the kind of concerted effort to destroy a particular group based on, their characteristics. So it's not very workable, and that is a conscious effort to label and frame something in a certain way so action happens, or at least that you alert and alarm people. But I'm not sure how effective it's been, because I think people are increasingly like, yeah, but what are the options? If you do believe that's occurring, your options are very limited.
With the world member states that are aligned or part of the United Nations, do they not consider to be a toothless giant when you consider that some of these states have got veto powers?
Mm-hmm.
In their own self-interest, for example, Russia saying, no, don't do that because they're actually selling weapons to the other side.
Yeah.
Where is the credibility internationally with the United Nations when it comes to security?
Yeah.
That's where there's a lot of faith, where they can see, like Bosnia, places like that. Tanks being held up with guys at 303 saying you can't come through.
Yep.
They're a toothless beast.
Yeah, and that's one of the concerns, is that in the past the UN has been constrained by the mandates. So that's what happened in Srebrenica. In 2008, when they released the Capstone Doctrine, they very, very carefully had managed to manoeuvre language in that all states agreed to. I'm not sure how they did this. Must've been over drinks on a Friday or something. But the Capstone Doctrine says that the UN can use force now in defence of the mandate. So if you can get a mandate through the UN Security Council which says the UN must deliver humanitarian aid, then you can use force to get trucks through. You don't have to be shot at first. So the UN now, and that's basically what's happening in Africa, is a lot of that, the robust stuff is happening there. But the problem is you need to get the mandate to do it, and you won't get the mandate in Syria. So there's still weird, that's the element where the national interest comes in, is in particular countries or places where veto powers have a real interest, then action won't happen. But having said that, the UN has teeth in places where that isn't, you know, kind of hasn't been stopped at the beginning.
Do you think the veto would be abolished, or what?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole thing. It's
the credibility
of
the United
States.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. This is the thing. I'd love to say yes, but no. So 2005, basically what Kofi Annan brought before the council was really imaginatively titled Plan A and Plan B, where basically he wanted to change the composition. Member states, particularly veto members, look like they might be more ready to change who's in the council. So maybe let a couple more states in, because at the moment you've got 15 members, so the E10, the elected 10, the non-permanent 10, and the permanent 5. But that's to represent 193, whereas back in the day it was originally 10, then it got increased. I can't remember, that's terrible, but I can't remember exactly when or how many. But, proportionally out of 50, that was a good representation. So some might look at increasing the number of countries, but then they said, but then there's a committee problem, you just have more people to disagree. So that's stymied. But the reform effort was really interesting. He basically brought forward a couple of suggestions for doing away with veto, and everyone went, no. And he said, okay, so, all right, so permanent 5, you're all insisting you maintain your veto. How about, and the UN, there are actually clauses in there, and this is partly why Libya got through, is that if it's in your own national interests, you are not supposed to exercise the power of veto, you're supposed to abstain. So he said, why don't we strengthen that and just kind of others decide or help you decide if you really shouldn't be voting. That didn't go down. But the other thing which he suggested, which I thought was brilliant, was that maybe you get proportions of veto. So maybe the US gets a half and China gets a half. And if you can get some mates, maybe you can make a veto. I was just cracking up thinking about what would Britain and France get. But that didn't go anywhere either. Or maybe you can have so many vetoes a year, but they haven't managed. And I don't think they will. And the thing is that the UN is reactive. So nobody wanted to know about the responsibility to protect until Iraq. And I think that's what will happen with the UN. When there is a crisis of some sort, maybe something will change, but it needs a crisis. And in the meantime, what they're trying to do is just... The big thing at the UN is I do know a lot of people are there who basically just want to keep some more people alive that wouldn't have been kept alive otherwise and try and improve their lives. And that's kind of... If they can do that, the high politics stuff doesn't matter. You know, if you're getting pencils to a school or a well in a place, then you're succeeding. And I guess it depends on what you take as success. Yeah.
All right, Stuart, you have...
Isn't it unrealistic to sort of say about the UN always failing with various things? You're trying to do something massive in getting countries to agree on something, and over time these things might evolve gradually rather than the idea of we not getting to the end result already.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's what was happening with the R2P stuff, is they felt that maybe they were getting some agreement. And again, that's kind of gone out the window. But I think it's really interesting. The more I'm in this field, the more I think, yeah, but look, I mean, Trump's in, everything changes, Biden's in, things change again. When Xi's term potentially finishes, or Putin goes, is there a chance for other things, you know, to kind of maneuver? And also I think increasingly we've got things like the pandemic, you know, they're major shocks to a system, or climate change could be a major shock to systems. So some of those external pressures might bring about change, but otherwise it tends to be slow, crawling towards consensus, and then sometimes it works.
I think we've done our time at this stage because we've passed 1 o'clock. I think if you want to have a quick chat with Beth afterwards, I'm sure you're more than happy to do that. So can you just please join with me again in thanking Beth for her presentation.